Wishing each of you a belated happy Thanksgiving. Hope that you did well with your travel. If you need to schedule counseling this week, I can be available. Sometimes getting together with family can be difficult, but it's good to see you. We're beginning a study today and going to last more than a week, studying the last great miracle. And as we've spent the fall studying the miracles of Jesus, we're falling in love with Jesus all over again. And we've used the miracles in class to do that. And we need to study the raising of Lazarus. And there's so many dynamics to the story, so we're going to take our time and study John 11 for the next few weeks. I want to begin laying a foundation for the chapter by referring to the movie Shadowlands. It came out in 1993. It's the story of C.S. Lewis and Joy Gresham. Joy Gresham was a divorced American who went to Oxford to meet C.S. Lewis, to get to know him. She was aware of his writings. And in the story, they began a long-term friendship. And I want to read you something that he said as he would lecture at Oxford and other places, and then relate it to the movie before we begin the study. I encourage you to find Shadowlands. You will enjoy the movie and its factual in its presentation. C.S. Lewis lectured. He was an atheist. He came to be a believer. He was a lecturer at Oxford and in other places, and he said, "Pain is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. We are like blocks of stone out of which the sculptor carves the forms of men. The blows of his chisel, which hurt us so much, or what make us perfect." And that's true. It's not easy to hear, and it's not at all easy to go through. But I believe that's a truism in many ways. They fell in love. She was diagnosed with cancer. And in the later years of their relationship, he proposed to her. They were married only a short time before she died of that cancer. And on their honeymoon, they were walking, and it started raining, and they sought cover, and she said this to him. Actually, this occurred just before they married. I've got two quotations mixed up. "I have only now just seen it. How you've arranged a life for yourself where no one can touch you. Everyone that's close to you is either younger than you are, or weaker than you are, or under your control." And that opened a door for healthy discussions, a romance, and a short-term marriage as she died of cancer. Here's what I want us to hear in addition before we go to John 11. Let me just say it before this rain stops and we go back, that I am going to die, and I want to be with you then too. The only way I can do that is if I'm able to talk to you now. I think I can be better than just managing. What I'm trying to say is the pain then is part of the happiness now. That's the deal. And it's a movie that forces you to look at the dynamics of death, which is the last enemy. So I've written material on John for a number of years. Have over 960 pages on the Gospel of John. It's one of my favorite studies. And it's the last miracle, not chronologically, but the last great one, but it's also the last enemy. We see Jesus conquering death, and he does that, of course, with his resurrection. Let me offer an opportunity for a response. How many of you have seen Shadowlands? I see four or five. I'm sure you can find it, very inexpensive. It's a very profound, factual movie. I think you would enjoy it, though it deals with several difficult subjects around the quotations that we've shared with you. John 11, verse 1, a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now was sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. And so the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." Jesus was in Bethany. If you've ever read any of Frank Viola's work, he's written one just called Jesus. But Frank Viola has also written a work, a book, and it's short, on Bethany. And he refers to it as our Lord's favorite city. About 2 miles outside of Jerusalem, he retreated often to Bethany. Mary and Martha and Lazarus were there, and it gave him a place to get away from the hustle and bustle and certainly the danger of Jerusalem in that last half year of his ministry. But he's there with them there. He falls ill, and they send for Jesus. I'm intrigued with what happens. There's so many elements of this chapter. This is the first time that Mary, Martha, and Lazarus appear in John's gospel. They'll appear later in chapter 12. They will become very well known to us because of the things that we learn about them. But the message was very clear, and it's a message without a request. That reminds me of the first miracle we studied, the first Sunday of September. Jesus was in Cana of Galilee, and he was at a wedding feast, and Mary, his mother, appealed to him, basically saying, "They've run out of wine." And kind of suggesting, "And you can do something about it." What to me is this, Jesus answered. It wasn't his time, but yet he did it. He produced the best of wine on that occasion. But it's similar here. Just give him the information. Not sure what will happen, and they had no clue. We'll see later. Just let him know what's happened. Lazarus is sick. And I want to take a parenthesis moment for just a second. How many of you have seen The Chosen? If you haven't watched that, you need to find it. It's free on the Angel Network. If you have a smart TV, just look for Angel Network. Get the icon, The Chosen. 2 seasons are finished, and you can watch them free. You will not see the topics that you study in the Bible the same way after watching that. And by that, it puts a personal face to the stories. It puts a personal face to the story. And they're very well done. They're not pretending to be factual in every regard, because it's trying to show a day-to-day story of Jesus and the apostles. But when you come to an event, it's very much according to the scriptures and not confusing at all. when you get to actual stories, but day-to-day things are put with it. But I found in my 20-plus years of working on the Gospel of John a story that fits here. C.F. Andrews tells of two friends who served together in the First World War. One of them was wounded, left lying helpless and in pain, and the other, close to death, crawled out to help his friend. And when he reached him, the wounded man looked up and said, "I knew you would come." And I hope you have friends of whom that can be said. Who can you call when there's a difficult situation in your life? And it's okay if it's family. But we all need people that we can call when difficult things happen, knowing they will come if they're able. Someone told a story to make the same point. How many of you have a pickup truck? How many of you have been called to help move a refrigerator? And that's one reason not to get a pickup truck, to be called on to move very heavy appliances or furniture. So they need you for your truck, but they also know that they can call you in such a situation. I've made my point twice. They knew they could tell Jesus about what had taken place. That's true friendship. They knew he would come if he knew it. And Jesus, in verse 4, when he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. And when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. Does that sound loving to you? To hear that your good friend has been called by two other good friends, Mary and Martha, Lazarus is sick, implied, "I know you will come." And John tells us of the relationship. Remember the first time they're mentioned in the Gospel of John. John tells us the relationship, and he tells us why, before giving us the facts, we're going to wait 2 days, why he didn't travel. And watch the twofold reason. The first reason, he knew the end result. And what was it? It's not going to end in death. And that's the greater concern. Being very sick is not a fun thing, and it's not making light of that. But their concern, and Lazarus, not knowing this, was very concerned, I'm certain. But John tells us that Jesus tells his apostles, "This will not end in death. My words, a greater good will come from this event." God's glory. God will be glorified. And in order for God to be glorified in this, and at the highest level, because there would be glory if he'd just gone and healed him, but the greater glory needed to occur, and Jesus wanted to use the circumstances for that. In our study of John 16, last week briefly, we talk about we are called as Christians to bring him glory. And we're called to that glory as Christians. What we do, how we live, it's to bring glory to God. God used this situation, the healing of the blind man, same thing, John 9, but for God's glory. He didn't do anything. There's no sin involved in this man being born blind, but God can be gloried in this moment, and he used it for that circumstance. But he loved him. He knew he wouldn't die ultimately. It wouldn't lead to permanent death, we should say, because we know the story. And God would be glorified in this. And after 2 days, he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." And again, Bethany, if that was one of his favorite cities, as Frank Viola suggested, he got away for danger purposes, and they're very quick to tell him that. "But Rabbi, a short while ago, the Jews tried to stone you, and yet you're going back there?" And if you watch The Chosen, there are several times where they will raise an issue with Jesus, called him Rabbi. They raise an issue with Jesus and question where they're going or why, what, when, as a result of those things. And so that's not common. And verse 9 is a very profound principle that speaks to the ministry of Jesus. He teaches them, he tells us after the fact. Jesus answered, John 11, verse 9, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? A man who walks by day will not stumble, for he sees by this world's light. It is when he walks by night that he stumbles, for he has no light." Now he's using the analogy of traveling under the safety of night, of darkness. It's safe to travel when it's dark. You can't be seen. You can slip in. You can slip out. But he alludes to the fact that in my case, a man who walks by day will not stumble, for he sees by this world's light. And so he's associating the physical concern of going to Judea. He acknowledges what the apostles have raised, the concern they have. But he's also acknowledging the reality of he works in the light. He doesn't stumble in the light. In other words, I can see clearly what's ahead. I'm not making a mistake. And he uses the analogy of travel and his awareness to make the points. We're going. We're going. And walking in the light, you don't stumble. Suggesting, I'm not making a poor decision here. We're going to see Lazarus from Bethany, about 2 miles away, as I'm remembering. After he had said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up." It takes a tremendous amount of faith, as death could be just literally, and you know it, just around the corner, to see it spiritually as Jesus would have us see it. He's wanting them to understand it by his language. I have come to associate it with the simple statement that whatever we're going through, and however imminent our passing might be, it's one breath from eternity. It's one breath from eternity with God. And he wants us to see death that way. There's an uncertainty. There's a concern. There certainly is a separation of those left behind. All of those things, but for the righteous, is one breath from eternity. And here, he's fallen asleep. It's an analogy, not death, it's just a short-term unawareness. I'm just in a short-term unaware of what's happening. And he says, I'm going to wake him up. And when we get there, I want you to be ready to share and answer a question that's kind of interesting. Did he do Lazarus any favor to bring him back to life? To have to deal with life again? The pain and the suffering of living in this world as a Jew, not that far from being under occupation by Rome, all the ramifications of life. When my dad passed away, he had gone through type 1 diabetes for a number of years, and it was at a time when there were not many generic insulins available. He was sitting at a table on one occasion and just said matter-of-factly, "Well, I'm supposed to be dead today." And everyone looked at him, his 9 children, his wife especially, "What are you talking about?" He says, "Well, I was told when I started using this insulin that it would no longer be effective after," and he quoted a certain amount of time. And he was a chemist, and he just figured, I'm outliving the effectiveness of this insulin. And he just matter-of-factly said it. Didn't smile, had very little response, it's just a fact of what I was told. It's a blessing for us to acknowledge some things and see them from a spiritual point of view to help with the physical concerns that would come. And it's a great sign of faith. When Dad passed, it was on a Monday morning after Thanksgiving. And I thought of him Monday. And when I heard it, very quickly, I said, "I'm so thankful for him. Sorry for us, thankful for him." And would we wish him back? Probably within a short period of time, he would have had both of his lower extremities cut because he'd been without a feeling other than the pain of the nerves and things like that. Would we wish someone who's left this life passed into the presence of God, Abraham's bosom where there's rest, waiting for a second coming? Would we wish them back? Isn't that selfish on our part? I think so. I said it. I think it would be. But it's a human response. It's natural. Because we would like to have them back. We'd like to see them one more time or whatever it may be. So he was only experiencing sleep. I'm going to go and wake him up. And it's not a new expression that Jesus is giving, but it's certainly more explained in this chapter. His disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better." Did they understand what they'd just been told? No. If you haven't watched The Chosen, I encourage it. I looked over at Terry this week as we watched one of the episodes, and I said, "I'm not so certain, had I been there for this event," I don't remember what it was, "but I think I may have understood it more than I think I would before seeing this." To see some of the things Jesus did in person, I'm beginning to think there would be many things I would still not understand. This is one of them. But when they show in that and you get to put the human touch to it, you get to see it, if you will, more than read about it, I think we probably would have believed a little quicker than we think we would. That's only an assumption. But I think if I had seen that, I would have had more faith later. Not in everything, not understanding a whole lot more, but I would have had more faith because of seeing that. And it's one of the chosen episodes. If he sleeps, he'll get better. In other words, what is the best thing for our health? What have you been told? Good night's rest. The best thing for our health is a good night's rest. And because of that, we can get better. There's a healing element to it. I call it a miracle to sleep and be so dormant and so unaware, if you will, and yet your mind's going crazy, and then you wake up refreshed, hopefully, if you slept well. Their assumption is a correct assumption. Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. And not confusing, John tells us there was confusion about this. And John, writing from a spiritual standpoint and much deeper in his approach to the story of Jesus, wanted that to be clear at this time. And he then told them plainly, Lazarus is dead. Make no mistake about it. He's dead. No confusion. He saw they were, knew they would be. Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I am glad I was not there. John tells us that on purpose because of what Mary and Martha are going to say as he approaches Bethany. You remember what they're going to say? Lord, if you'd been here, you could have done something. Lord, if you'd been here, you could have done something. How many times do you think they had thought that over the 2, 3, maybe 4 days from beginning to end they had to travel? How many times do you think they had both thought that? Where is Jesus? He could do something. And it's the first thing that seems to come off their lips when they see him. If you'd been here, you could have done something. They didn't understand what. They didn't understand the reality of what they were saying. Just something. But he says, I am glad I was not there. Why was he not there? He told us already this event will lead to glory for God. And here he says, I am glad I was not there, verse 14, verse 15, and for your sake I am glad I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him. He wanted the disciples to believe what was about to happen, to be convinced that he had that power, that he could do what he was about to do. This event is so that God's Son may be glorified through it. Verse 4 and verse 15, so that you, the apostles, might believe. So let's go to him. He knew what he would do. He knew the result. It was worth what they went through. It was worth what they would have to deal with. It was worth him hearing Mary and Martha saying, if you had been here, you could have done something. Then Thomas, called Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. I wrote down in my Bible, pessimistic courage. We're courageous, but we're seeing the probability. Now, why would Thomas think that? Well, what had they said earlier in the chapter? Are you going there? Don't you remember that just a short while, verse 8, the Jews tried to stone you? and yet you're going back there? Thomas, pessimistically, with courage, says, then you're going to die. And let's go with him, he suggests to the others, let's go with him, and we too will die with him. It's just in their mind, the reality of what's probably going to happen. It's a very profound chapter with all of its ramifications. Would they die for the cause of Christ? Absolutely. Not here, not in Bethany, not because of this circumstance. We need to deal with one miracle before December ends. And it's in the garden. And it's Peter with a sword in his hand. And what is he doing? He's defending Jesus in the garden against Roman soldiers. And Malchus's ear gets in the way. What was Peter aiming for? This is the high priest's servant. What was he aiming for? His neck, in all likelihood. And as they were leaving the upper room, we haven't gotten there yet, they left, they were prayerful, he's giving solid instruction as they're walking, but there's the idea of taking a sword, of the impending danger that they were about to walk into as they would travel with Jesus on these last hours. Let us also go that we may die with him. And they did later. To their credit, to their glory, whether they understood it now or not. On his arrival, Jesus found, verse 17, that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. So he waited 2 days and 2 days to travel. He had been in the tomb for 4 days. Why does John tell us that? Yes, Marion, absolutely, he was dead. There's no trick. There's no deception. There's nothing left out there that would suppose anything different than his waiting and the time involved. Lazarus was dead. Now, Bethany was just less than 2 miles, 15 strata, about 3 kilometers in my study notes from Jerusalem. And many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. Now that's just the opposite of what we would have thought. If we remember the time when Jesus was in this home with them, and Martha was in the kitchen, worried about the meal, Mary was there with Jesus, listening intently to his teachings. And Martha, in the story, I'm going to paraphrase it and add the reality of what took place, Martha finally became exasperated by Mary because, I need you in here helping me. This is an important meal. Come in here and help me. And she apparently appealed to Mary. And Jesus said, she has chosen that which is better. Mary had chosen the better of the two, telling us the preparation of the meal is less important than being with him and listening to that which he had to say, and showing her love and respect. All of that would be clear in the circumstance. We were at a congregation not that long ago in the state of California. I won't tell you anything else except to say that they would have afternoon meals from time to time after the morning service. And after communion, before the sermon, way before the end of service, about seven ladies would get up and go to the fellowship hall. And what did they show was most important on those Sundays? The preparation of the fellowship hall and the preparation of the food is more important than worship and hearing the lesson and all else that would take place. And it was their long-term habit. I taught this story, and I encouraged them to acknowledge one thing. I didn't speak with names, but I spoke to the congregation and to the elders, and two of the elders, it was two of the wives. No one in this auditorium wants to eat 15 minutes sooner that would cause you to miss worship. Anybody say differently? I made it very specific. I get in trouble sometimes by doing that. Anybody want to eat sooner that would require ladies of the congregation missing worship? No. Don't miss worship. I would rather that we never eat here again, if that's what we're encouraging. I don't know if anybody does it here. I bet you hesitate now, and that's okay. She has chosen that which is better, being in worship, if you will, the metaphor of being with Jesus rather than worrying about the meal. In this case, Martha is the one who's come out. Mary stayed at home. That's somewhat surprising to me, maybe not to others. Lord, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. If you'd only been here. Sten?
And in modern times, if it weren't for the consistency of God's creation and the predictability of God's creation, what we would consider miracles of medical science would not exist. And so when we see somebody who has overcome an illness because of medical science, that's to God's glory.
Good point. Yes, Dan observed that sometimes even with modern day medicine, which is like performing a miracle, it's still an accreditation of God in what he's allowing, what he's giving mankind, and what's being provided. I can't remember personally, I may have, but I'm not remembering a person personally saying that I went to the doctor last week and they were shocked to tell me that there's no more cancer. And the doctor was surprised, and I said, I'm not surprised. I have many people praying that I would be healed. But I know that has happened a number of times in the circles that I've been in, and probably for you too. We pray that God give us a healing. I pray that. We usually say, God, your will be done. Restore them to their much-wanted health. That's King James language. But I was taught a number of years ago, let's just be straightforward. God, we want them healed, but your will be done. Let's not leave it out there as if we're not sure what we're saying. We want them healed, but your will be done. And if you'd been here, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. And he says, your brother will rise again. If I'd been there, I would be confused too. The chosen hasn't moved me that far alone. He will rise again. Martha answered, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. And for those that you are studying with, it's a direct statement from Jesus that there is an afterlife. If we've doubted it, add this to your list. There is an afterlife. We will rise from our physical death. It will be a spiritual resurrection. It will be in a body made for spiritual presence of God. 1 Corinthians 15, imperishable compared to perishable. Your brother will rise again. I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. And Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. It's one of the I am statements of Jesus. He who believes in me will die, will live even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. And then he asked her, do you believe this? And we'll close with her statement of verse 27. Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who was to come into the world. I ask you, did she believe it? Does that that response signify belief? Yes or no? We would say, well, just say yes, say no. But she answered it, I think. She gave the reason behind her belief. Understanding it, I don't know. But she gave the reason for believing his statement that I am the resurrection and the life. I believe that you are Christ or Messiah, the Son of God, who was to come into the world. We woke up Tuesday, saw on Facebook that a sister in Christ had passed away on Monday. She was having some brain surgery in Georgia over a year and a half ago. She had complications. She was without oxygen for about 16 minutes, and she became a living vegetable. And she spent most of the last year and a half in her husband's home in Georgia, unable to speak or move or respond except just a little bit in her eyes. And he was a faithful husband to her in every way, watching and helping and turning and changing tubes and all manner of things. And she passed into eternity, he told us Monday. We saw it Tuesday, and we immediately were so thankful for God bringing her home to get out of that situation. Faithful Christian, she's in a better place. He knew it. We know it. But it's such a blessing. It's a blessing. And the blessing here is that he is the resurrection and the life. Her physical life ended, others it ends, but there's an afterlife. There is an eternity. And this gentleman who was at the congregation where we ministered over 12 years sat on the third row right in front or behind us most of that time. And he knew. He knew. I want to read you a statement that I heard and shared. My Kindle has gone silent here. If Jesus can do nothing about death, then whatever else he can do amounts to nothing. Do you believe that? Do we understand that? I don't know where I got it. It's in the back of all of my Bibles, and it's part of this study. If Jesus can do nothing about death, then whatever else he can do amounts to nothing. It's comforting to us to realize that He is the resurrection and the life. And they will live again. She's relieved of a life of agony, bed sores, a number of things. Our good friend in Madera, 24-year-old young man, his dad said at his memorial, he no longer is dealing with hospitals and needles. It's a blessing. And when we realize those things, we handle it much better. Thank you.